comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful, beautiful planet we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. We're here because you have a right to know, and frankly, you matter. Well, based on the email that's come in over the past several days, I would have to conclude that the shows this past week were fairly stellar. And I think this week will be as well. You know, we try, and I mean that, we try to make every show that way. But we need your help. The economic situation keeps rocking along near the bottom of the river all around the world, and we are a listener-supported show. We don't play any commercial spots on the show. Last month, we had only about half of the revenue to come in that we actually require, and this month is riding at about the same level as last month. Now, last month, we were able to ride out that storm by using a very small reserve that we had set aside to pay the bills that we have to pay, but that's gone now. We used it to continue into this month. So there are only a couple of weeks until all of those due dates hit us again. So look, if you've got an extra buck or two or more, stand with us by making a donation to the show. If you like this show, if you enjoy it, help us be here next month, okay? Help us make it to the end of this month. And you do that by just going to my website, and you'll see the button that says donate. Just click that and help us out. Comet Elenine is all the buzz on the internet, and it has been, in fact, the buzz for a few months. I've received emails, and we've had some callers to the show who have asked me what I think about this Comet Elenine that's coming in. Well, there are all kinds of rumors out there about this object, and I've taken time to look into the most prevalent of those rumors and to try to determine if there's any truth or at least any basis for truth in any of these rumors. Well, tonight, we are going to look at Elenine in some detail. And I'm going to present to you the very best information that I have been able to find about this. Like all our shows, this will be controversial. No one's asking you to believe anything at all. My job is not to get you to believe something. My job is merely to present to you the information that I've been able to find. It's up to you to decide whether you think it's accurate. And in fact, I'm in no position to say which theory is the most accurate. So it's up to each of us to make our own determination as to what we think is the more accurate information. We will be joined on the other side of this break by Ted Tweetmeyer, electrical engineer, former project director for a project at NASA, and a frequent guest here. We look forward to it. We'll be back right after this. Well, Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And we're talking about Elenine this evening. Now, some people refer to it as Comet Elenine, and others say it may not be a comet at all, and that's part of what we'll talk about here tonight. But I want to make sure that all of us are on the same page and know exactly what it is that we are talking about. Elenine is an object that is in space. It is in our solar system. It is moving into the inner solar system. It will go around the Earth, and it will cross the orbit of the Earth very, very close to the Earth. And some people are saying it's a comet. NASA says it's a wimpy comet. Others say, you know what, it may be a brown dwarf. And when I say others, I mean some scientists are saying that. And so I just want to get as much information in front of you as we can. I have weeded out stuff that I think is obviously not true. And the first one, just to give you an example, this we'll call it a comet. This comet, this object, was the announcement was made in 2010 that it had been discovered. It was named Elenine, E-L-E-N-I-N. It is pronounced, actually, Yelenine, if you pronounce it correctly. It's Russian. But one of the most widely disseminated rumors out there is that Elenine is not named after a real human. This rumor says that E-L-E-N-I-N is actually code for something. And they say the code stands for Extinction Level Event Nibiru is Near. I've seen this, scientists are not saying that, but I've seen this on some forums and websites. And then I've seen a variation of that. It is Extinction Level Event Nibiru in November. Well, this has gotten a lot of traction. It's created a lot of fear. And a lot of people have been saying that the name Elenine is this coded message and that it's not really named after a real person. It's a coded message for those who are clued in, but it's done so that it will not panic the uninformed or the disinformed. Well, that's an interesting possibility. However, it is definitely not true. There really is a person named Leonid Elenine, and he's a 29-year-old amateur astronomer in Russia. When he first detected this object, he was actually using an observatory in New Mexico. And so he's credited with documenting the existence of this object, therefore it bears his name. He appeared recently on a Russian TV news program and showed his Russian ID. Those who are watching our TV channel are looking at a picture of Leonid Elenine and his Russian ID. He told the Russian TV news that he was a little bit miffed at people using his name to open up fake Facebook accounts and other web pages, and I understand that the Facebook account using his name has been taken down. I haven't confirmed that, but I did read that. In addition, he is part of the International Astronomical Search Collaboration staff. He is a staff volunteer. And he is listed on their website along with a picture of him. So, you know, this is a real person. Elenine is a real guy who really did discover this object out there. So it does not mean, and you can put this to rest now, it definitely does not mean Extinction Level Event Nibiru is near or Nibiru in November. I've also noticed in doing my research for this show that there's a lot of COINTELPRO work going on out there in the various internet forums. COINTELPRO is a term that refers to government operatives who infiltrate into various groups, UFO groups, paranormal groups, etc., for the purpose of creating high tension and disunity among the members of the groups. These folks are paid government agents who post in various forums and blogs and who do nothing but try to shred any idea that gets too close to the truth. Folks, these people are not mythical. They're very real, and they use specific methods to accomplish their goal of crashing any group or organization dealing with real facts about UFOs and extraterrestrials. They do exist. They do operate. They are called COINTELPRO. Now, I've posted a video in our own forums that will help you to be able to identify these people when you see them in any forum or any blog. Just be sure you go over to my forums and check it out, the KSS members area. As I said, there's a great deal of COINTELPRO going on with reference to this space object called Elenin. They've worked overtime to ridicule, slam, scam, and sham almost every theory that's come up, including theories put forward by credible scientists. And I've been monitoring. It's not just in the forums. It's not just on websites. It's in email groups as well. I've been monitoring an email group. This particular email group includes some of the top names in our genre. And some top second-tier names as well, names you would be familiar with. And then some plain, ordinary folks. I have not participated in these discussions, but I have merely monitored what's being said and who's been saying it. Among that group is Ted Tweetmeyer, an electrical engineer and former NASA project director. Ted finally had enough of all the fire and rage that was happening in the group, and he sent the group a link to an article published by the European Royal Astronomical Society. It is an article written by Dr. Mansour Omerbashic. Amazingly, one of the very opinionated but very well-known physicists in that group wrote that this made sense to him. Ted Tweetmeyer is my guest this evening. Ted, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's great to be here.
Now, what I am about to say may cause me to get cut off the air, folks. So if that happens, let me thank the morons who do that in advance. Why? Because it will have proven to the audience that what we're saying here is accurate. Ted, you've heard me say, you've been listening, you heard me say that I've been monitoring the rhetoric in that email group. Are you aware that there are at least two and perhaps a third COINTELPRO operatives working in that group?
Yes, I am, Kevin, and they are extremely vicious at times. They, you know, I've been writing a little article called American Then and Now, referring to, you know, our country's past Americans, those great men that gave us what we have today, and what's happened to Americans today. But in doing so, this whole subject you're talking about also came to light. And the problem is that when you present information that's revolutionary, unusual, or out of the mainstream, out of the box, you're letting a genie out of a bottle. They can't stuff that genie back in the bottle. So the only thing that these agents, or agent provocateurs might be a good word for them, can do is to attack the messenger and try to discredit him and thereby discredit the information. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely agree with it. Yeah, that's one of the great methods. And here's an example. Dr. Mansoor Omer Bashic, he was attacked in one of these groups. Now, this paper that we're going to talk about, the things that he said, this thing was published by the European Royal Astronomical Society, and I mean that's not a little group. So anyway, I'm reading in a forum, one that's well known to be just absolutely infested with these COINTELPRO guys. This forum says, Dr. Mansoor has been cut out of the loop. He's been marginalized by, you know, the mainstream scientists and the credible scientists. And he even had a police raid at his house at 4 a.m. in the morning. And you want to quote this guy as some kind of an expert. Well, I have a couple of things I want to say about that. First of all, I have no reason to defend Dr. Mansoor. And I'm not defending Dr. Mansoor, and I'm not promoting him. But I do have a great many reasons to knock that kind of a crappy argument right out of the boat. And here's why it's crappy. First of all, who knows why there was a police, if there even was a police raid at his house at 4 a.m. in the morning, who knows why? Did it have something to do with his science, with his being a scientist? Does that in any way affect what he has accomplished as a scientist? It may be something entirely different. His neighbor's dog may have been barking, and maybe he shot the dog, and maybe the police showed up for that reason. Maybe there was a big argument between him and someone in his house. You don't know what the deal is. Has nothing to do with science. But folks, I want you to think about this. What would you think of a scientist? I mean, if you buy that as a reason why you ought to marginalize this guy's article about this incoming object, what would you think of a scientist who proposed something absolutely revolutionary and radical? Got marginalized by all the scientists. I mean, really got marginalized. Furthermore, he was deemed to be what we would call a national security threat, and he was placed under house arrest. Okay, would you say that this guy should be tossed out? Would you say that we ought to discredit and disregard anything he's got to say? Well, his name is Galileo. And he's the guy that established that, in fact, the Earth was in motion around the sun, and all the planets were as well. Now, all those people that persecuted him and all those people that arrested him and that kept him under house arrest and the big bad Pope at the time who said he was a heretic, all of that, those people were all wrong. And Galileo was right. So, you know, these COINTELPRO guys will use some kind of crap, some kind of nonsense like that, throw it at the guy, and expect you to be stupid enough to say, oh, well, I shouldn't believe this guy then. There were police at his house. Live long enough, there'll be police at your house. It's headed that way. Okay, now... that doesn't mean that I'm saying that what he wrote is true. It does mean that I'm saying that the nut that wrote that in that forum is very likely on the government payroll as a COINTELPRO operative. Very likely. Can't prove it, but it's very likely. So, having said that, let's talk about what Dr. Omer Bashic had to say.
If I may read some of the abstract to what he wrote.
All right.
I'd like to just hit a highlighter, too. He said, I here demonstrate empirically my georesonator concept in which tidally induced magnification of Earth masses, resonance, causes seismicity. Translated, that there is a induced magnification in the Earth that causes it to resonate and create earthquakes. That's what that means. To that end, I show that all strong, greater than M6 plus earthquakes in 2010 occurred during the Earth's long, greater than 3-day astronomical alignments within our solar system. Now, it gets even more interesting because he goes on to say, the same holds true for strong earthquakes for the decade of the 2000s. And then, here's something quite fascinating. He also states, I use the comet C/2010X1, which otherwise known as Elenin, as it has been adding to robustness in terms of very strong seismicity since 2007, and in terms of the strongest seismic activity since 1965. He goes on to say that the Elenin will continue intensifying the Earth's very strong seismicity until August-October 2011. So we see here that, you know, he's been calling it, and he also has a table in his paper about these encounters.
Yeah, he does, and I would have included it in our video tonight, except for the fact that that table is too long. In fact, there are three tables, I believe.
Yeah, but they are quite lengthy, you're right.
Yeah, it's too long to get it on the screen, but the point is, what he's saying is we can look at when the Earth is lined up with, when it's in alignment with other planets, and then we can look at the earthquake data, and we can see that the earthquakes that are six and plus, six or more powerful, happen most commonly within a 3-day period of that alignment. And furthermore, he says that this Elenin can be added to the mix. And in fact, Ted, he says when you add it to the mix, there are 30 to 40 more powerful earthquakes once you add Elenin to the mix. There are 30 to 40 more within the period which Elenin has been, you know, closest to us, and it's getting closer. All right, we have to step away for break. We shall return after this. Welcome back. We are talking with Ted Tweetmeyer, and we're talking about Elenin, and what is it, and what effects can it have? Now, we were discussing this paper that was written and published by the European, written by Dr. Mansour Omerbashic, published by the European Royal Astronomical Society, and in it, he says that the data, and he uses the word verify. He says it is verified that when this Elenin lines up with the Earth, when it's in alignment with the Earth, and particularly if it's the Earth and another planet or two in alignment, and then Elenin, then all hell breaks loose. We have a big earthquake. 6 point or above. Am I fairly characterizing what he's written there, Ted?
Yeah, that's what I understand it as well, Kevin.
And he uses the word "it is verified." And he uses that several times. Now, there are, of course, other scientists that would take exception to this and say, well, I don't think it's verified. But, you know, the data's the data. And it would seem to me that he's made his case. What would you think?
I agree with you. I think that, you know, I think he has, and he's trying to put this together in a way that, you know, no one else has really done before that I've ever known.
Well, I want to make a point before we move forward. Now, you've provided us with a graphic, and we're going to talk about it, and folks will get to see it. But before we do that, I want to make something very clear, folks. I want to make it clear that there is a big debate among scientists. There are scientists on the side of the NASA statement that this is a wimpy little comet, it's not going to do much, it's no big deal. There are scientists on the other side, and they say it is a long-duration object. And by definition, those are not little wimpy things. The reason they are long-duration is because of their size, because of their mass. If they were smaller, they could be slung around the sun in a smaller circle. But because of the fact that they are big, they have a long duration orbit. And so there are scientists saying that. And then there are scientists that are saying, you know what, it could be a brown dwarf. Now, I want to make a point here. I want to make a point that it doesn't matter. Well, it does, but I mean, either way, this thing could, it's capable, it could, in fact, cause a lot of damage. And I'm going to show you an example, and I'll describe it as well, an example of a very small thing having a big effect on a big system. On your automobile, even if you drive a small automobile, that automobile is heavy. Even a small one, you know, you don't want somebody to drive over you with it because even a small one is, you know, very heavy. It will crush you. So it's a big system. It's a big mechanical system. And if your wheels are out of balance, then that means that the car is going to shimmy and shake. And if you leave it that way, it will eat up your tires. Furthermore, it will destroy your suspension on the car. It basically shakes your car apart. Okay? So it's a very small problem, but it creates a big effect on the bigger mechanical system. Now, what does it take to fix that? What it takes to fix that is a tiny little piece of lead, a tiny little weight that gets attached to the wheel rim. They put the wheel with the tire on a machine. It finds and marks the spot where that weight has to go. And then they put the weight there. And now that tiny little weight that's on that wheel rim stops the shimmying and the shaking, and it stops the big mechanical system from being shaken apart. So it doesn't take a lot of mass if it's in the right place and if it's moving at the right velocity. It has enough force to have a big impact on a big system. And this comet, or whatever it is certainly has velocity. I read somewhere, Ted, that if this comet, if we had something leaving Earth traveling at the speed that this comet is traveling at, it could get to the moon, from the Earth to the moon, in 5 hours. That's moving. That's a lot of speed. So this doesn't have to be a big mass. But having said all of that, what do you think about its mass and about its gravity? And what do you think about it, Ted?
Well, compare this to other comets that have come in our neighborhood, such as Halley's. And Halley's hasn't really been credited, to the best of my knowledge, with creating massive earthquakes and tidal waves and the like. And the question is, what's different? You know, if we look at other comets and we look at this one has been seen for quite a long time. It's pretty massive. I've seen some numbers as high as 50,000 miles for the front of it. And as you say, it's on a very long type of orbit, very long, long orbit, with a long periodicity of measured in many, many, many years.
Yeah, I think it's about 1,800 years, isn't it?
Yeah, it might be that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this mass coming, and it will, if it has insufficient mass, it won't really affect us. Halley's Comet didn't do that much to us. And, you know, we sent a spacecraft out, fired a projectile into it, and much to NASA's surprise, Halley's Comet wasn't a dirty snowball. In fact, they found it was largely gravelly.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically have a large mass in motion, which makes it a comet. It's really a big flying asteroid, to really look at it. And we know that you can generate a plasma in space quite easily with motion. And we did this with STS-75. There was a satellite released on a tether, no bigger than a shoelace, made out of Kevlar. Of course, we all know how strong Kevlar is, stronger than steel. A 12-mile Kevlar tether was made and aluminized to be conductive, and from shuttle mission 75 was lowered down toward the Earth. Keeping in mind the shuttle always flies upside down and the payload bay doors are open. And, excuse me, when they got it out there quite some distance and a considerable amount of power began to flow, NASA figured it would be about a kilowatt, but more like 2 kilowatts of power, DC power was flowing, which is like about 2,000 volts at like an amp. And this caused a tether to burn through at its first electrical point of contact, which was a roller and a little tower in the payload bay. The little tower at the base of the tower was the large drum that held the cable. My point of this is that when that tether broke, there's a NASA video, and when it has been recorded, it was some 82 nautical miles away, and it was very, very visible. Now, this certainly was not sunlight. I mean, this thing was very visible with a glow around it.
As a matter of fact, you could see it from Earth on a clear night.
Yeah.
I saw it. Others saw it. It was like just this long glow in the sky.
Yeah, 12 miles long.
Mm-hmm.
It would be quite visible because you can see the space station on a clear night going overhead, and if you know where to look. So that's not that big compared to a 12-mile tether. So
mm-hmm.
Yes, it would be quite visible if you had the ability to see it and know where to look. So the point is, this thing was in motion. It wasn't just sitting in space. It was moving at pretty close to the same velocity of the shuttle, which is like 14,000 miles an hour. So if it was sitting still, maybe nothing would have happened. It would, you know, it would do nothing like anything else sitting in space. So now we look at this comet. It's in motion, you know, and if it's a comet indeed, you know, we don't know this yet, because if we look at it, it doesn't really have a tail like most comets would. You know, it doesn't really show a long, long tail, as you would expect. So it's apparently not giving off much material, and but it is having a large gravitational effect. So this is almost counter-contradictory. It's giving off almost no tail, like Halley's Comet had a long one, a couple million miles long. This one has practically nothing, and yet it's affecting the Earth. Now, that immediately says, all right, well, if it's a lot smaller with a lot less material than Halley's Comet, is it, and it's affecting the Earth, is it really a comet? That's a question.
Okay, now, I've got a question about this. There are some scientists who have been concerned that this may be a brown dwarf. But when we look at photographs of it, you know, it's kind of glowing green or greenish white out there in space. Would a brown dwarf do that?
Well, it's moving. See, it may be surrounded by a plasma. You know, that's entirely possible. In fact, if it is a star, it's a plasma and it's conductive. That's something, you know, we don't talk about that much, but, you know, star is inherently conductive because it is a plasma. Plasma is a gas. So there's tremendous electrical activity going on in a plasma. So if we put this in motion, perhaps it can glow white. And I don't want to think of it as a star, because the implications of that, of a rogue star, which we already do know there are rogue stars roaming around out there between solar systems. They've already captured those in telescopes. But if it's a rogue star, and it does come between the Earth and the Sun, as the orbital plots are saying, we could be in for quite an upset.
All right, we have to step away for break. And when we come back, we'll pick up right there. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer. We're talking about this comet, or whatever it is, Elenine, that is in our solar system and is set for a rendezvous with planet Earth. Describe for us, Ted, a brown dwarf. What is a brown dwarf?
Well, is stars go through, you know, various stages in their life. A brown dwarf is one of the, temperature-wise, you know, one of the stars with the lowest temperatures. In fact, I think it's like in the order of 2,200 degrees on the surface, which is significantly cooler than our own sun. But, you know, as a star reaches end of life, it begins to shrink as it consumes its fuel. And, it, you know, they've reduced in size substantially. Now, we don't really know exactly how a rogue star comes about. You know, we don't fully understand that process, and who knows, we may never understand it, you know. But,
okay, so now what size would this thing be? If it's a brown dwarf, it's not, we think of a comet as being rather small and compact, even though there are some of them big enough to be Earth killers. But there's, you know, relatively small and compact, smaller than Pluto. What are we talking about with a brown dwarf? What size could this thing be?
Okay, well, by definition, a brown dwarf is a star whose mass is just too small to have nuclear fusion going on in its core. So the temperature and pressure at its core are just, you know, too insufficient for fusion to take place. They're not very luminous, but they usually have a mass between, 10 to the 28th kilograms and 84 to the 10 to the 28th. Now, that may sound large, and certainly is. It's a lot of zeros. But if we compare that, for example, to, you know, our sun, it's got a temperature of 4,000 degrees, okay, where a brown dwarf is substantially cooler because it doesn't have fusion going on.
Okay, let's compare that in size, say, to Jupiter. How is it bigger than Jupiter or smaller?
Well, it would be... I'm not sure of the answer to that.
Okay.
It could be smaller, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But its volume may be smaller, but its mass would be greater, right?
Yeah, it very well could be more dense than that. Yes, it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, what set it in motion? You know, what kicked it off on this? If it is indeed a brown dwarf or something like it, what kicked it off on this long trajectory?
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it might be safe to say it's not a neutron star because it is glowing. If it was a neutron star, it would be just a black hole. And then that would be the end of story for all of us if that was a neutron star. But so they really consider white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, and pulsars and neutron stars faint and virtually dead stars.
Okay. You've taken a look at the various articles that are out there. I know for sure the one that we've been discussing you took a look at because you sent me the link to it.
Yeah, I did.
Okay. You've done some reading about this. Have you come to any conclusion yourself as to whether you think it is a comet or whether it's a brown dwarf?
Well, I don't think it's a comet. If it is affecting the Earth like this, I don't think it's a comet. You know, it isn't that close quite yet. It's still a couple planets out, mm-hmm. and yet it is affecting the Earth. Now, that's saying something about its mass, that it has a very significant mass. It's not like some giant asteroid that's, you know, flying around masquerading as a comet or what have you. It seems to have significant mass. And according to that science paper, it's been slowly affecting us more and more each year, mainly when the planets line up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't a believer in planetary alignment issues until I began to read some of the material that, I can't pronounce it, was it Mansouri?
Yeah, Omer Bashic. Omer Bashic.
Thank
it's
you.
A Bosnian name, by the way.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, when I first saw it, I said to myself, yeah, that's got to be a Bosnian name because I used to patrol when I was international police. I used to patrol in a place called Omer Begovica. And this was so close. I said, that's got to be a Bosnian name. And I did a little research on it and found out it is.
Their men are pretty big guys, too. You know, I know Bosnian brain scientist, geez, he towers over me.
Yeah.
They're like football players.
They can be. That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Omer Bashic wrote this paper, and he pretty well establishes with the charts and data that when the Earth lines up with planets, we have earthquakes within a three-day window. We have earthquakes of 6 point and above. And
wow. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then when El Niño is added to the figure, when it's added to the model, it becomes even more pronounced. And this is why I said earlier about the little weight that you put on your car's wheel rim to balance that wheel. Doesn't have to be big. It just has to be in the right spot and be spinning at the right rate, and it will balance out all of that shimmy and shake. And so, you know, I wonder if a small object out there in space traveling at a sufficient speed and coming into alignment with Earth could have an effect, something like that weight, but an opposite effect in that it causes us to shimmy and shake. Which, by the way, if you have a wheel that's in balance and you put a weight on it, it's now out of balance and it will shimmy and shake. So I wonder if this object could be causing something like that in our orbit. And well, not necessarily our orbit, but in our, you know, our geology. It causes us to shimmy and shake, and then we have those earthquakes. Could that be happening?
Yeah, perhaps so. I mean, we do know the moon acts like a stabilizer for Earth, mm-hmm. and almost like a flywheel. And without it, our weather, our tides, everything would be radically different than mm-hmm. we know it today. And, you know, the moon is only a couple thousand miles across, you know, significantly smaller than the Earth, and yet it can influence it. I mean, so we have a model for it right there in our backyard, so to speak, you know, of how these objects can influence our planet. Now, we add into this equation that there could be an interaction of this incoming object with the sun. Now, we do know from some science work that solar flares have preceded earthquakes. So now the picture gets a little more complicated, you know, and I guess we're almost getting to that point of that graphic we talked about. But
okay, well, I tell you what I want to do. We have a break coming up here in just a few seconds. I want to hold that graphic till we come back from break. But, you know, we know there's a relationship between the solar flares and the sun, and there's been a lot that has been written and said about that by various people. But then the question might be, okay, so what is there something that's influencing the solar flares? Maybe they're not the cause. Maybe they are an effect.
Yeah.
And maybe there is another cause out there that's doing that. All right, we're going to step away for just a couple of minutes. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer. We are talking about this object in space that is headed our way at a very rapid clip. It is called Elenin. Before we went to break, you had mentioned that you're ready for us to see this graphic that designed for us or sent to me. And I'm going to put that on the screen, and I will describe it for those who are listening via radio. We have the comet, or whatever it is, up in the upper left-hand corner of this graphic. We have the sun just slightly lower and to the right, and directly under the sun we have the Earth. And we see yellow arrows pointing to the sun, from the comet to the sun, from the comet to Earth. We see two sort of wave lines between the comet and the sun. And then we see a dotted circular yellow circle between the sun and the Earth. So what are we looking at?
Well, basically, I'm trying to roughly show the possible interactions here that, you know, would be taking place, and the influence of that incoming comet or object, whatever it is, on the sun and Earth. So, as you pointed out, you know, are the flares which occur before the earthquakes indicative of what this other object is doing? is this object's been coming in for a very long time. In fact, quite possibly since the beginning of the solar flare preceding earthquake, observations have been made. So it's quite possible that that whole mechanism isn't really between the sun and earth only, that it's also related to this other object out there. The wavy lines represent kind of a warping in space. It's possible if this comet is some type of a star or dwarf, hopefully not, I should say.
Yeah, but if it is some kind of star, we hope it's a dwarf.
Yeah, we hope it's a relatively low mass. I'm not sure we know exactly what the smallest possible mass could be for it to be a star. Is it a chunk from a star? We don't know everything we really need to know about stars.
We don't even know everything we claim to know.
That's true. There's a lot of assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they just found out some 10 years ago that the galaxy they were using for a yardstick to determine spaces between stars and also the age of the universe was off by some 47 million years. And it was a little embarrassing for astronomers to find out. I think it was M47 or M51. I'm sorry, I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah, there went a whole raft of PhD dissertations.
They changed their yardstick galaxy to another one.
Okay, so when we look at this graphic, what you're saying is that the incoming comet could be having an effect on the sun, which is producing those solar flares, and that is what is producing the earthquakes.
Yeah, I mean, the flares precede the earthquakes, so is it possible that the sun's maybe not necessarily causing the quakes, but it's acting like an indicator to say, okay, space-time has been affected around the sun, which is now creating these massive flares, some of which eject mass into space that never returns to the sun, which, if you and I talked about this on another show. So we're connecting some dots here, to try to understand this better.
Yeah, but, alanine, this may be a little bit difficult for people to imagine, but I think they can do it. Alanine, like every other object in the solar system, is always in alignment with the sun. No matter where the Earth is in its travel around the sun, it's in alignment with the sun. Okay? But alanine, when it's got an open shot at the sun, would have, we'll say, a gravitational effect. Now, some people would say, well, it would be so small it'd be negligible. Nevertheless, it's there, so it would have a gravitational effect with our relationship with the sun, we'll say, of X. Now, whenever the Earth and alanine align, that puts the Earth between alanine and the sun. So when they align, that gravitational effect on the sun would be Y, not X. Okay? So maybe it's the bounce back to X, or maybe it's the bounce from X down to Y that causes the fluctuation on the sun that's causing the solar flares.
Yeah, I did not show them all lined up because the clutter of lines would become a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
But do you follow what I'm saying? Everything in the solar system is always aligned with the sun. Okay, because it's the central point.
You're talking about what they call the orbital plane of the planets.
Well, no. Even if you're coming in below the ecliptic, even if it doesn't matter, you always have a line between point A and point B, the sun being A, B being Elenine. There will always be a line possible to draw between the two unless there are planets that float in between, that get in the way.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. And so it's when they align, maybe that little bounce of gravitational relationship from X to Y, as we line up with Elenine, it drops to Y, or minus X, we'll say. So you have X and minus X. So you have X, and we come into alignment. We get in between Elenine and the sun. Now the gravitational relationship between Elenine and the sun drops to minus X. Okay, when that happens, maybe that's that little bounce is what flares off the solar flares that are causing the earthquakes. Or maybe, what do you think about this? Maybe there's no relationship between the solar flares and the earthquakes at all. Maybe it is purely the gravitational relationship of the alignment that's causing the earthquakes, but it's also causing solar flares.
Well, that's more or less what I was saying a few minutes ago, yeah, that the sun is more or less an indicator of something happening, but not necessarily the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And when the planets line up, that they cause like a blip in the curvature of space-time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that blip is what affects us. I mean, you know, we have... Hey, here's something to consider, okay, that makes no sense at all, but we're supposed to believe it, right? We have the Earth's core, which is generally assumed to be in molten state. Through a mechanism we don't fully understand, it stayed molten for an incredibly long time. Then we have, like, 2,700 some odd miles of hard, solid, mantle, okay? Then we have, like, 20-some miles of crust, all right? But anyway, the thing is, why would we have volcanoes if we're that far away from the molten center of the Earth? But the bottom line is, we do. So somehow things are hotter up near the surface than they would be down where things are solid. Makes so much sense, doesn't it? But anyway, mm-hmm. The bottom line is that we know that deep down it gets hotter and hotter. So we have the Earth is kind of like a shell floating around in a molten middle. So it's quite conceivable that it would become susceptible to these gravitational influences, perhaps more than we think. In fact, years ago there was a documentary, and on this one they stated that the traffic on the New York State Thruway between Albany and New York City, which is like 350 miles, two-lane traffic, is sufficient to move the Earth's crust on the core. That's kind of interesting. That's not a lot of horsepower when you think about the mass of the Earth. So if it really is that delicate, then there may be something very much to be said about this interaction with this incoming object and the Earth.
Well, you know, I think a lot of times when we think about, well, you know, our magnetic field, which is not the same thing as gravity, but the magnetic field around the Earth, you know, it handles all this massive radiation coming from the sun. We must have a heck of a magnetic field around the Earth, and it must be, magnetism of the Earth must be very powerful. And yet, you can take a magnet small enough to hold in your hand and pass it over anything where there's some iron filings or pieces of metal, and it will lift them right up into the air and onto the magnet. So it's not that strong. And what I wonder is gravity. We think about the Earth having, you know, that gravity is very, very strong. But maybe it is a weak field as well.
Let me point something out here that might be helpful.
Okay.
There is actually a connection between magnetism and gravity.
Oh.
The proof is that the strongest magnet in the United States is this Megagauss magnet that the National Magnetic Laboratory has. Consumes a staggering amount of power. It fills a building, and the actual space in the middle of a magnet is only big enough to hold a frog. And when this thing is turned on, any object they drop in the middle will levitate. It will float in a zero-G environment. You know, there's been videos and tests done. They show a frog just, you know, flipping his little legs around. You know, he's floating upside down, turning around. He's a true zero gravity because the magnet has warped the local space-time and basically nullified gravity in the middle of that little well in that giant magnet.
Hmm. Okay. So then it takes a giant magnet to do that. So gravity must be a much stronger force than magnetism.
Well, the interesting thing about magnetism, okay, is that while it seems kind of weak, you know, and it's certainly not going to cause a metal nail to fall out of your hand, you know, but it's spread over a tremendous number of square miles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I think that's an important distinction. You know, can you imagine attempting to build a magnet that strong that could encompass a planet 22,000 miles in diameter? That would be a major trick to do.
Well, yeah, it's a heck of a magnet, but the overall effect of it is pretty weak because we can overcome it fairly easily, but not so with gravity. We don't have anything we can hold in our hand that'll make us float.
Yeah, a magnet, by the way, just to finish that, falls off the square of the distance. So if it does, you can imagine at the magnetic core of the Earth just how powerful that thing must really be. In fact, it's almost incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and gravity, now, there's a very interesting subject. You're going to get me started.
Well, good, because I've got some things I want to discuss about alanine and gravity, but go ahead.
Okay. Gravity is an interesting case. There was a scientist I read about many years ago over in Europe. He found two vertical well shafts, 4,200 feet deep, some distance from each other, hundreds of feet from each other. I forgot the exact number. I mean, close to a mile, but anyway, he wanted to test the theory that everything should point toward the center of the Earth. So he lowered a 60-pound plumb bob on a piece of steel piano wire down the center of each one. He then carefully, because there was a connecting tunnel between the bottoms of these things, he then carefully measured the bottom of the plumb bobs and, of course, the top. Physics says the bottom will be closer to the top because they're both going to be pointing in toward the middle of the Earth. But that didn't turn out to be the case. They did not do that. Now, he was deeply disturbed, and according to the article I read, the experiment was repeated here in America and found the same results. So...
Okay, so I don't understand. Now, it should be pointing towards the center of the Earth, but it wasn't.
Right. I mean, the bottoms would be, you know, closer together by a very, very small amount, you know, because they're not that, they're in the order of a mile apart, and, you know, the curvature is pretty small, but it should be measurable, but it wasn't.
Hmm.
It wasn't any. So the question is, you know, how does gravity work? Now, the farther you get from the surface of the Earth, the less you weigh, so to speak, right?
Right.
Now, what happens when you go below the surface of the Earth, toward the middle?
Well, you would think you would get heavier.
Would you? Because in the center of the Earth, you wouldn't weigh anything. All the forces would be equal. See the interesting problem here?
Yes. Quite a paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. If the center of the Earth was hollow and didn't have a hot core and you could get there, you should be able to just float around inside that big chamber, like zero gravity, because all the forces would be equal. So it's conceivable the maximum gravitational force would be at the surface.
At the surface, yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to look up some time and see if anybody's taken any, you know, digital scales down into gold mines or what have you to see, you know, what they found. But
I was discussing this with another friend of mine this week, and he had an interesting observation. He said, you know, makes you wonder whether the Earth really has gravity or not. Does the Earth have gravity, or does the Earth just suck?
Well, in fact, some of the more recent theories say it's a push force, not a pull force.
Yeah.
Now, if it is, if it's a push force, we've got a eureka moment here, because we have this object coming into the solar system. We have it influencing the Earth and possibly the Sun. And maybe it's actually pushing on the plates.
Okay.
Causing, you know, these terrible disasters. And, of course, since gravity falls off with distance, logically, then the closer it gets, the more intense the effects would become. In fact, if it is any kind of a star, the effects are going to be pretty horrible. They're going to be bad. And maybe the calendar is off a year, and this really is 2012, but that's another story.
Okay, well, let me you know, the example I used of the X and minus X force being applied in this relationship between Elenine, the Earth, and the Sun. You know, sometimes I know you've done this. You're an engineer. You build things, and there are times when you're trying to break something loose from something else, and it doesn't want to turn loose. And maybe you have a screwdriver, and you put it between the two things, and you hold it with one hand. With the other hand, you just sort of, I guess you could say you just sort of pop it with your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that little pop. It's not much force, but it's just that little bit extra as a sharp shock force for just a nano moment. There it is. Okay, so you do that, and it works. It breaks the two things apart. Something like that, if it's a push force, then you could, instead of X minus X, you could have X plus X, so that as Elenine lines up with the Earth, it's that little pop of extra force that pushes against us. Would that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And like we were talking earlier, you know, the possibility of the gravitational warping of space between the Sun and all the way to the incoming object is interrupted or added or subtracted to by all the planets in alignment for a brief period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that could very well cause a ripple or perhaps a wave of gravitational force in space.
Do you know, and this would be interesting because of what you said about it being a wave, a ripple, do you have any idea, when we get into alignment, do the flares happen right then? Do they happen after, shortly after that alignment?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know they happened before a quake, and, you know, but I'm not sure if they happen during the alignments. The funny thing about solar flare data is it's actually not easy to come by. You know, I wrote an article a couple months ago about this whole thing, and you know, all I could find was data back like a month, to define the M and the X class flares. And that was on an Australian website, the Royal Oil Observatory, I think they call it down there. But, I couldn't, it was actually hard to find older data because I was trying to correlate it. I was creating a spreadsheet to correlate the data of flares and earthquakes, and it turned out to be a bit of a challenge. So I did do it the best I could for about a 3-month span.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you constructed a chart for us based on that. And I remember you had a difficult time finding all of the data. All right. Now, the next big alignment happens in October 2011. The big alignment between Elenine and Earth, and I forget, there's at least one other planet in alignment there. But what happens is this alignment brings Elenine right across the orbital path of the Earth. Very, very close to the Earth. A distance of 0.233 AU. Okay, now the Sun, an AU is the distance of the Earth from the Sun. 93 million miles, give or take a few. That's one AU. This is going to be 0.233 AU away from us. Is that significant?
Actually, you know something, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is something I've been following since the 90s, keeping myself in trouble. And that is, there was a...
Okay, you know what? We have a break coming up. I know where you're headed about the way we measure things, and I want you to have time to explain that, so we're going to wait till we come back from break. Folks, we're talking about Elenine, E-L-E-N-I-N, Elenine. It is an object in space named after its discoverer. His name is Leonid Elenine. And we're talking about the possibility of this thing not being a comet. But even if it is, it could be a problem. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Ted Tweetmeyer. We're talking about Comet Elenine or Brown Dwarf Elenine. Some people say it's one, some people say it's the other, and by people I'm not talking about those of us in the unwashed masses. I'm talking about scientists. Some of the scientists are saying it cannot be just a comet. Some of them are saying not only is it a comet, it's a wimp. It's a little bitty, insignificant comet. And so, you know, we're just trying to determine what does the data tell us. And we've been discussing this article written by, oh my goodness, I have to look at it to say it, Dr. Mansoor Omerbashic. And he presents data in this article, published by the European Royal Astronomical Society. He presents data that says Elenine is having an effect on the Earth. It is every time it comes into alignment with the Earth, and every time, especially if there are other planets in alignment, we get these earthquakes and big ones. And he provides the data that shows that over a number of years, really over the decade from 2000 till 2010, And he shows that in that period of time, there are more big earthquakes than in the preceding period of time. And so, anyway, now we were talking about, Ted, we were talking about the fact that this thing is supposed to cross Earth's orbit. It's going to go right in front of us and at a distance of 0.233 AU. That's very, very, very close. That's closer than the moon.
Yeah.
And you were about to say something about the
distance.
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Pardon me for interrupting. I forgot about the lag there. It's one quarter of the distance to the sun.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you were about to say you'd been watching about distances over a period of time?
Yes, in fact. I've been tracking near-Earth asteroids, and there's an ongoing table of some of the more recent little fun objects out there. Now, normally these NEAs are typically measured in AUs, like you mentioned, is the distance of the Earth to the Sun. Now, amazingly, there is a table. They're all in lunar distances. There's 13 of them. And from as close as one on June 2nd, 0.9 lunar distances, which is, of course, just a little less than a distance to the Moon. Fortunately, that rock is only 10 meters or roughly, you know, 30 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
But the missed distance will be, it'll miss Earth by less than that distance to the Moon. So there are some other much bigger ones. But, you know, this could almost be another show in itself, because I keep asking myself, like, why is it? I look at this table, that all the 1 kilometer size asteroids, and there's like about 7 of them, why are they on the order of 40 to 70 lunar distances away, and yet the little ones are, you know, like I said, that one's 0.9, there's a 48 meter one, that's 9.9, and so forth. Why are all these little ones so much closer? It's almost counterintuitive in a way. So the question is somebody or something out there keeping them from hitting us and letting just the little more annoying ones get through that'll probably burn up in the atmosphere on their way in?
Hmm.
You know.
Well, we can trip through that patch of tulips here in just a moment, but I want to grab this before we
sure.
Move away from Elenin at all. Elenin crosses Earth's orbit. If their calculations turn out to be correct, it should happen October. I believe they say October 28th of 2011. So that's coming up. That's real soon, October the 28th. And it's going to pass closer to us than the moon, much closer than the moon. Even if it happens to be a little comet, even if it happens to, if the NASA version of this happens to be correct, they say that we will pass through its tail. Okay, well, if it has a tail, which is not showing that in the pictures so far, but if it's got a tail and we pass through the tail, we could still be in for a lot of debris hitting the Earth. So it still could be very destructive, could it not?
Yes, it very well could be. I mean, there can be objects you can't see that are invisible, and you know, hopefully they'll just burn up in the atmosphere and they won't reach the surface of the Earth. So,
okay, now, let's say that it's not a little wimpy comet, and let's say that it's a not even a brown dwarf, but it's something big. We'll say several miles big. and we pass through the tail, that could be really destructive. If it's a brown dwarf and we pass that close, it passes that close to Earth, what can we expect to happen on the Earth?
Well, it will, you know what the moon does to tides.
Yeah.
So we're talking a much bigger object. It would could conceivably lift the oceans, you know, and create, as the pole sweeps across the surface of the Earth, it could create, you know, tidal waves of a size completely unknown in Earth's recorded history. I mean, you know, maybe a mile or two high. I also wanted to point out real quick that on the March 11th event that happened in Japan, that there was an Elenine Earth-Sun and Earth-Mercury-Uranus alignment on that day.
Okay.
That was worth pointing out.
All right, now, October the 28th, 2011, this thing is supposed to pass very near to the Earth. It heads on back out into space. But that doesn't mean we stop having alignments with it. As it goes out, we will have alignments with it, just as we had alignments with it coming in. So as it goes out, the next major alignment after October the 28th, 2011, the next major alignment happens on, you want to guess the date? December the 21st, 2012.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
That is interesting. That's very interesting. So
yes, and it's also worth noting here that the scientists said the strongest seismic activity will increase around the 20th of October this year. And upon the comet's crossing of the Earth's orbit on the way out, only to continue subsiding until the year 2016. So, you know, next year may mark a very significant influence on the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
I think this year will be bad enough, to be honest.
Well, what I've said about this whole 2012 scenario is that I don't think December the 21st, 2012, I don't think it is the Earth Buster.
No.
I think it marks the end of a whole bunch of really bad catastrophes. Not a sudden end, but it's like, okay, now it begins to cool off. Now it begins to subside. And I base that on not on astronomy, but on the Mayan calendar and Mayan prophecies. What they say is it's not just the end, it's the end of an era and the beginning of another one. So when if I look at that and I say, okay, well, now this era we're having a crescendo of the number of earthquakes and the intensity of earthquakes and tsunamis and bad weather all over the world, it's crescendoing. So if the Mayan calendar has any accuracy to it at all, if it does, then December the 21st, 2012, marks the end of that crescendo, and we then go into a decrescendo, a period where it begins to slack off and things begin to get better. And that seems to be what the scientists are saying here. Do you, you mentioned it almost seems as if somebody or something is keeping the big chunks of rock away from us, and only the little ones get close enough to us to be of much concern. Do you think that it is someone, or do you think it is something?
Well, you know, in an older show, we talked about this issue of the planet, and I don't have any doubt whatsoever, there's other intelligent life here, and if there is and they're not making contact, then it only can mean one thing, the observation and resource collection. If the Earth is the resource that it appears to be, then they'll have a very much a vested interest to protect their resource. So it would make sense. You know, if they have that technology to deflect stars, planets, or what have you, then if that's the case, then maybe nothing will happen, and we won't understand why. You know, one minute the thing will be on its way here, and all of a sudden it'll be on its way out. We won't know how whatever happened.
Okay, but if for the sake of discussion, we'll accept the idea that there's intelligent life, non-human intelligent life, and that they are viewing this planet as a resource. Well, wouldn't it be a much greater resource if we weren't on it?
Not necessarily, because I believe we're one of the resources. The DNA is definitely being collected and taken, so we're clearly one of the members of this gigantic self-maintaining vivarium.
Okay, so we're bacteria in their petri dish.
Well, I think we're more like along the lines of animals in a university research laboratory. I mean,
we're lab rats.
Research subjects, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like we're a little farther up than bacteria. You know, we're intelligent life forms, or at least we're pretending to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing is, we don't know if bacteria considers itself to be intelligent.
Well, you know, what's interesting is there's an amazing intelligence in virtually every life form that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's even insects are seem to be capable of some form of thought. You know, maybe not on the level we think, but, you know, they have enough intelligence to fulfill what they need to do.
All right, now this intelligent life that considers Earth a resource and is bouncing the big rocks away from us, where are they?
Maybe it's like the old Star Trek, you know, general order, you know, don't interfere, you know, non-interference prime directive kind of stuff. But, I mean, you know, when we've come close to war, things have...
Right, we'll have to get the rest of that when we come back from break. Where are the ETs? We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Ted Tweetmeyer, and we've been talking about Elanine, and we were talking about where this intelligent group, this intelligent extraterrestrial group might be. Ted, any guess?
Well, we've got some solar systems that are, you know, as close as 12 to 14 light years away. And years ago, we used to think the nearest one was 100 light years away. It was Alpha Centauri, but we found out that apparently that things are way closer than we thought they were. So it used to be thought that, you know, at 100 light years away or so, that was the closest one when you and I were younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we have found out that our universe is a great deal different than we were taught by the PhDs. Of yore.
That's true.
Okay, now back to Elanine. Look, even if Elanine is a wimpy little comet, it's still accurate, I think, based on the data produced by, I have to read it again, Dr. Mansour Omerbashic. The data produced in his article, or reproduced in his article, based on that, we would have to say that it's accurate whether it's a wimpy little comet or a big bad boy of some sort. Either way, it's accurate to say something evil this way comes. It's going to be a rough ride. Would you say
that's true?
You agree with that or disagree?
Huh?
Do you agree with that or disagree?
Well, yeah, I do agree, because even if it's not a dwarf, and it is, it isn't a dwarf star, and it is a comet, it's pretty massive, and you know it's going to cause some effect to the Earth, I'm sure, as it passes by. I don't know how it couldn't, really. You know, not just gravitational, but whatever else debris it might be trailing behind it. You know, there could be, you know, chunks of rock as, you know, as big as houses, and we wouldn't see them yet. So,
you know, in a fight, if the opponent is bigger than you, he's got a longer reach than you've got. And if you cannot get completely away from this opponent, you're safest nearest, so that he cannot get full extension on his punches. Okay? So you're safer nearer. Would we be safer nearer this comet? Or is that the wrong way to look at this?
Well, I don't think in this case it's better, because the closer you are to, you know, some source of gravity, then the stronger the gravity is going to get. So I'm not sure close is necessarily a good idea in this case.
Well, and we don't have a choice. It's going to be very close. It's, you know, less than the distance to the moon.
Yeah.
Something
happens. I mean, on its current course.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to qualify that by saying what we know right now, yes, it will be that close, unless something steps in.
Do you think it's possible that we have the technology to aim some kind of beams at this thing and move it off its course?
That's kind of iffy. I'm not sure that we really do, even the classified stuff, to do that. I mean, you're talking, it may not have weight, but it does have mass, you know? So it's like, you know, it's got mass behind it. I guess a good example of how that works in space was some years ago they put a new electronic system in the Hubble telescope. It was about the size of a phone booth. On Earth, they said it weighed something like 1,000 pounds. In space, one astronaut pulled it out of the payload bay by two handles, and holding on to it, while he was, of course, on the end of the arm, he very slowly, and when I say slowly, it took him like a half an hour to move it ever so slowly between the payload bay and this big opening in the Hubble telescope and put it in there. And he had to go slow because it had mass. You know, once it starts moving, stopping it can be difficult. So, you know, so that went pretty well.
So if this doesn't have that mass, and if for some other reason it's bumping the Earth with gravity and causing these earthquakes, if it's not because of its mass, whatever, it doesn't matter, whatever it is that gives it the ability to do that will not diminish as it gets closer. It will get stronger. And so we can expect more earthquakes and more destruction, if I understand what Dr. Mansour Omer Bashic, what he wrote, if I understand what he wrote, that's what he's saying.
It does appear to be that way. I mean, I think that's right, you know, and what I gather reading it. But
okay, but you seem to be coming down on the side of it's got mass. It's bigger than a comet.
Yes, because, you know, Halley's didn't affect us. And Halley's was close enough to get a spacecraft to and fire a projectile into it, which puts it relatively close to Earth, you know, because we don't get that far out into space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they discovered Halley's wasn't made the way they thought it was. NASA was quite shocked, but the people of the electric universe theory said, yeah, well, that's what we expected.
Uh-huh.
And that finally made NASA listen, because the electric universe people told them before they fired the projectile what they were going to find, that it's not a dirty snowball. So,
okay, so what you're saying is that Halley's doesn't have that effect on us. So this has to be something bigger than Halley's.
Exactly. Bigger and more massive anyway,
mm-hmm.
whatever way the mass is coming. But it, we could say, okay, so far we know it's creating its own glow. So it's apparently moving fast enough to do so. You know, which what an asteroid would do. If you move an asteroid fast enough in space, it'll start glowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
we're normally, you know, a comet, we don't see it until it gets close enough to the sun that it begins to react to the sun.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. You start to see the tail off it, which is plasma and whatever else is trailing behind it.
Yeah, and you know, everything has a tail on it in space if it's in motion. Even the Earth has a tail. A lot of people don't know that, but the Earth has a tail behind it as it moves through space. All right, we have run out of time, and Ted, I want to thank you for being with us again this evening and for providing so much of the information that we have covered here tonight. Once again, just stay on the line with me. Once again, folks, I'm not saying that Dr. Mansoor Omerbasic is correct. What I'm saying is he is a credible scientist, and we have to take what he says into consideration. I'm not saying that NASA is correct or that they are wrong when they say it's a wimpy little comet. Maybe they're right, and I certainly hope so. But even if that's the case, and you look at the data that is in this article that we've talked about tonight, this wimpy little comet seems to be kicking the heck out of the Earth every time it lines up with us. So it's, I think, accurate to say, whatever it is, something evil this way comes. Something wicked this way comes. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.